Sorry I had to cancel the class last week. I told some of you, my uncle turned 93 today, and his younger wife is 85. And these are not people that I really associated much with growing up. My father's older brother, they used to live in Washington, D.C. We always lived on the West Coast. But a few years ago, my sister sort of started taking up with them, and I got involved, and they have no children of their own. You know, it's just in this country, older people just end up without any help. So they moved from one retirement community to another, and I offered to help them. And after 4 days, which is all I'd planned to spend there, it was just half done. And I just didn't know what would become of them if I left. So I stayed, and just until I unpacked every single box and put everything away. And then they just faced the problem of living, but at least the problem of moving was settled. It's very easy to see why the sight of elderly people and old people was enough to make Buddha renounce the world. Make Buddha renounce the world. The whole story of the life of the Buddha was that his father kept him sequestered from the view of the inevitable result of human life, which is old age, disease, and death. And when he finally broke out and perceived it, he immediately renounced the world. And I just kept thinking the whole time I was with them, you know, this is just what happens. And if you rely on anything external for your happiness, in the end, you will just be left with nothing. And how many times have we done it? I find it very spiritually stimulating to be with elderly people. I mean, I didn't do it for that reason, but that was the side effect of it. You just feel like, one of my friends told me that after his baby was born, he got so serious about his kriyas. You know, many new parents use the excuse of parenting to sort of get sloppy in their sadhana. He became absolutely fixed because he saw what lay in store for him unless he really got his act together. And, you know, seeing these elderly people, even Swamiji, your body just doesn't respond. You expect it to respond, and it doesn't respond, and you just have to have an inner life, or you got nothing. My uncle puts it humorously, it's not any one thing that's so bad, it's the sum total of the collection, is how he puts it. But, you know, the body just wears out like an old machine. Anyway, okay, so now we'll go forward with Gita class. We have a lot of verses in this particular section. We're still in the chapter Freedom Through Renunciation. We finish it tonight. Chapter 5, verse 13 of the Gita. When once the embodied soul has controlled the senses and mentally releasing every attachment to activity, remains blissful and secure in the city of nine gates, the physical body, he himself no longer acts, nor does he impose action on others or on his outer senses. 5:14. It is not God, the sovereign self, who creates in mankind the consciousness of acting in this world. God neither causes people to act nor entangles them in the karmic consequences of their actions. It is Maya, the cosmic illusion, which acts through them. 5:15. The all-pervading is not concerned about people's sins or virtues. Wisdom, though it is the natural state of every man, is eclipsed by cosmic delusion. Mankind thus becomes bewildered as to the difference between right and wrong. 5:16. This is 5:16 through 5:28. In those, however, who have banished ignorance by wisdom, the true self shines forth like an effulgent sun. Their thoughts, immersed in that one, their souls united with it, their entire devotion and allegiance absorbed in it, their being purged of the poison of delusion by the antidote of wisdom, such liberated souls achieve the state of no return. Such souls view with equal gaze a pious priest, a cow, an elephant, a dog, and an outcast. Even on this earthly plane of existence, the relativities, birth, death, pleasure, pain, are overcome by one who views all even-mindedly. Those who can do so are verily enthroned in the unblemished, never distorted spirit. Such sages, established in the one supreme being and unwavering of discrimination, are neither jubilant when they confront pleasant experiences nor depressed when they confront painful ones. Feeling no attraction to the sensory world, whether subtle or gross, the yogi lives in the ever-new joy of his own being. United to spirit, he attains perfection in absolute bliss. O son of Kunti, Arjuna, because sense pleasures spring from outside the self, they all have a beginning and an end, and bring only misery. No one of any understanding would seek happiness through them. He is truly a yogi who, while living on earth, and up to the last moment of his earth life, can master every impulse of desire and antipathy. He alone among mortals is a happy human being. Only one who possesses inner bliss, who is firmly centered in the inner self, and is illumined by the inner light, dependent on nothing outside the self for his understanding, attains complete liberation both while living and after death. His doubts and hesitations removed, his karmas all obliterated, his senses subdued, his delight only in the good of all, he, the sage, attains emancipation in spirit. Renunciates who are without desire or anger, controlled in mind and self-realized, are inwardly free, whether living in this world or merged in the infinite. The Muni, one for whom liberation is the sole purpose of life, controls his senses, mind, and intellect, removing himself from contact with them by neutralizing the currents of prana and apana in the spine, which manifest outwardly as inhalation and exhalation in the nostrils. He fixes his gaze in the forehead, at a point midway between the two eyebrows, thereby converting the dual current of physical vision into the single, omniscient spiritual eye. Such a one attains complete emancipation. 529. He finds peace who knows me as the enjoyer of all offerings, yajñas, and austerities, as the infinite Lord of creation, and as the dearest friend of all. Thus ends the fifth chapter called Freedom Through Inner Renunciation of the Upanishad of the Holy Bhagavad Gita in the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna, discussing yoga and the science of God realization. Well, those are some good ones. Not as if this book has a bad chapter. Do we have anything left over from 2 weeks ago? I had written myself a note here. Let me see if I can make sense out of it. I think I didn't comment last week on just something that was in the commentary, which I just wanted to sort of speak a little bit to. Now, there's a reality that's happening in this world right now, which is we're moving from the age of form into the age of energy. This is Kali into Dwapara Yuga. I often have a reason to comment about this because the state of marriage and relationships is in a particularly liquid form right now, because all of the structures that used to hold that fundamental relationship together in society have just gradually, as we go through this transition, have all sort of moved away. Traditional roles for men and women, the traditional stigma against divorce, against sexuality outside of marriage, against children being born outside of wedlock, and all of these situations are just, none of them hold anymore. And as a result, there's nothing to hold a couple together accept their actual genuine desire to be together. That people can just walk in and out of relationships so easily. That's the good news and that's the bad news. The good news on that is that people are making experience the criteria of their morality, which is in itself a good thing, as Swamiji put it, because eventually experience will teach us divine law. And I'm not saying that marriage, one marriage for life is divine law, but there's a certain amount of loyalty and self-discipline that is required for success in relationships, that a too easy exit often allows people to come right up to the edge of the point where they could begin to really transform themselves, and instead of undertaking that difficult task, we shy away from it and we exit. As often as not, the forcing individuals to stay into life in lifelong relationships that were not fruitful, I think probably more harm than good was done, but I don't really want to say. But there are many cases in which the fact that one couldn't separate forced a level of positive growth and positive development that would never have been possible otherwise. A friend of mine, an older woman, older than I, not older than I am now, but older than I at the time, remarked once, I at that time, she and her husband had a really lovely relationship. It was about 45 or 50 years of marriage at that point. She confessed to me that the first 28 years were hell. And the only reason they didn't separate was because it was just impossible, too, in society as it was at that time. But after 28 years, they both finally realized that they needed to think more about serving one another than trying to get from one another and give each other more freedom and various things. And it just turned into, by the time I knew it, into a really exemplary relationship. Now, I'm not really talking about relationships now. What the Gita talked about and what I wanted to talk about was the quality of renunciation. Among the many things that Yogananda's mission has been dedicated to in this world is the creation of dedicated spiritual communities that are not based on the traditional lines of what dedicated spiritual communities have always been based on all through Kali Yuga. I mean, there's always been dedicated communities, but they have been monastic for almost as long as we can remember. We have in the Bible the intriguing comments about how the early Christians band together, lived communally, and formed communities. It's an interesting fact that you can tell this is all in the Acts of the Apostles after Jesus died, that apparently forming cooperative spiritual communities for householders as well as monks and nuns was one of the tenets of Jesus' mission, because it's what they started doing immediately after he passed away. I mean, just one more interesting similarity. And for the same reasons that we're doing it now, they did it then, to give each other strength in this new way of life, to because their reality was so different than the world around them, it was difficult to maintain. Unless they pooled their resources, it was a new way of thinking and being, and often people need to move apart a little from society and relate to people who are in tune with them to build up the magnetism and clarity about what they're doing. It was very interesting for me to digress. I was speaking about having spent this week and a half with my relatives, and they live outside of Philadelphia, and David was in Europe, and we weren't in contact by phone, and we were in very little contact by email. I was by myself. I was totally outside of the Ananda atmosphere. I think it was the longest, most complete separation from the Ananda atmosphere that I may have ever had. I went to my parents once, and I became quite ill, but I think even then I was only there for about 5 days. And it wasn't like, you know, I fell into a state of dark night of the soul or doubt or anything like that. But it was very vivid to me how different from our consciousness the consciousness of most people is. And just living my own reality, I could see there were so many factors of why communities are important that came to me, not the least of which was a very interesting one. If you're the only spiritual person around, the only person committed to these teachings, you can get a false idea of how really special and advanced you are. because you're measuring yourself against people who don't have the same aspiration at all. So you seem really quite dedicated and even quite remarkable to them. Just the normal, cheerful, serviceful attitude of an Ananda devotee. It's really quite remarkable on a day-to-day, day-after-day basis in most settings. In the context of our community, it's just normal. It's just, oh, there's a job to be done, let's do it. I know after my parents moved out of their home, I took a little crew of Ananda men, Raghu and Rick and Gary and David, and we went down and cleaned out my parents' house. We just did it in one big day, you know, load after load to the dump and so on. And I mean, they were just so happy and cheerful doing this really sort of thankless, messy task. There wasn't the slightest sense of it was anything but just a sheer delight to be serviceful to one another. But I was conscious of the fact when I was outside of the Ananda context and just all by myself that my normal everyday attitudes were considered quite remarkable. And that's very dangerous in many ways for the devotee, because you'll think you're tall because you're measuring yourself against short people. It's extremely important to be in an atmosphere in which you are constantly reminded of the distance that you have to go and can't fall into the thinking that you've accomplished more than you've accomplished merely because you're unique. I mean, that's one of the benefits. And the other benefit was, I mean, this wasn't like I was tempted, but I watched these things. I remembered this when I had been ill at my parents' house. And I remember sitting, watching television with them, and realizing that if I announced to my parents, oh, you know, I'm sort of tired of living at Ananda, I think I'll just come and stay with you all for a while. To them, that just would have seemed like a perfectly wonderful decision to have made at that point. There would have been extraordinary consternation at the other end, but at their end, that would have just seemed like, why not? You've been there a long time, and I mean, there would have been a certain amount of, well, finally you've come to your senses, or it was cute for a while, but I'm glad you're moving on. Whereas, of course, from the ashram side, there would have been this, what is wrong with her? What's happened to her? I noticed it with my aunt and uncle. I became a vegetarian at the age of 19, and it was not a discipline. It was just, I lost all interest in eating anything that could move under its own power. And but there I was serving them food constantly, and, you know, it began to look interesting to me. You know, fish and meat, and not that I was actually tempted, it was just more observing the samskar and how easily samskars can be awakened again and how valuable it is to remain at a distance from them. I recall it was very vivid when, many years ago, my parents were very simple in their tastes. We were not wealthy people, we weren't impoverished, but they never really spent money on things. They just lived in a very practical way. My mother had a few things, but not much. But and we children never used any of it. You know, a little bit of crystal, a little bit of china, but it was only for guests. And I was at a friend's house with Swamiji at Ananda Village in the early 70s, and she had a set of very fine china teacups. And she served us tea because it was Swami in these fine china cups. And I was just a young girl in my 20s, and I picked up this very delicate cup, and I drank the tea out of it. And I think it was the first time I'd ever done that. And the sensation of that very fine porcelain on my lips was very pleasing. You know, it was very delicate in the whole beauty of it. And I said, my, this is lovely. I could get used to this. Very seriously, Swamiji said, be careful. He said, Master said that before you become a yogi, you experience all levels of human fulfillment. He said, those samskars can be very easily reawakened. Don't mess with it. And that's what I was watching, just living there with my aunt and uncle. How easy it would be to just say, oh, you know, you really need someone to help you. I'll just move into the spare room. You know, it was just like I would be doing something worthwhile. They would be grateful to me. I wouldn't have to worry about supporting myself. And, you know, gradually I would start eating salmon. And, you know, it was just like, it would just all just come back over me so easily. Things that would be impossible even to consider living among devotees who share spiritual values. And believe me, this was more like observing my mind rather than actually being tempted. But you see how interesting it is? When I came back and pulled into the community on Friday night about 10:30, and opened the car door, it was like the vibrations of Ananda just rose up like this healing cloud and came over me. And I mean, I've always been aware of it as holy ground, but I think it was the most, except for the very first time I went to Ananda in 1969, I think it was the most vivid experience I ever had of the vibration of our community. Because it was suddenly like I was back after having been so far, so completely separated from it. Now, all of that is to say, and this is where I was talking about form and renunciation, that what Master is having us do is something quite new, which is our community does have a form. All of this that I'm saying is very real. At the same time, it doesn't have that rigidity that we have relied upon for so many centuries. Even though there's a greater form to the spirituality of what we're doing as a sangha, as a living community, and also as a spiritual community that encompasses all those who attend. It's not just about geography. It's also being involved in this reality on a day-to-day basis, because I know not all of you live on the property, but nonetheless, you're constantly stepping into the vibration and keeping yourself renewed in it. At the same time, we also have this, it's a permeable community. We're always sort of moving in and out of other more worldly contexts, whereas, and we don't wear a costume. You know, a costume is a very helpful thing to wear. If you have a shaved head and an orange robe on, then it's not only that you are constantly reminding yourself, but no one around you mistakes you for an ordinary person. You know, your commitment is there. David still wears this yellow ribbon around his wrist. I haven't yet figured out a satisfactory way to wear it. For some reason, the ribbon remains pristine on him because of his control over the material world, I think. And on me, it just looks mungy in about 2 days. But finally, David said, "You just can't wear that. That's just too creepy looking." But I am trying to have manufactured just a little yellow band. You know, I would like to have on my person at all times something that I can see that says, "I am a member of a monastic order. I am a member of a religious society. I'm not just living an ordinary life." But otherwise, we don't have any external reminders of this. And even the vows that we take, and even the communities that we live in, are so light on the form. You know, we didn't just, the women especially used to, you'd step in that monastery and then they would cut your long hair, which in itself was just, a woman never cut her hair. And they would, you know, sanctify you in front of the altar. And then the power of the Catholic Church was such, you know, you could never walk away from that again. And many, many of the nuns, most of the nuns, just walked into those convents and the doors shut behind them. I mean, they just never came out again. It was a remarkable life. It feels very familiar to me, so it doesn't have a quality except that, oh yeah, that was fun. You know, you go to Assisi and you see where St. Clair lived, you walk through those buildings and kind of remember the way. Look out the windows in the courtyard and remember being there. But of course, there was tremendous protection in those forms. Just as I was talking about marriage, it wasn't always that a person kept their vocation by any means. There were many deeply disgruntled people in those places. In fact, one of the reasons why Swamiji, and of course it's less obvious in our urban community, it was more dynamically true at the village where it was more, we were more separated, but he always wanted people to keep their own money so that no one would get stuck. He wanted it always to be that you were there because you wanted to be there, that it was always a free choice and not merely because you had no options anymore and no property and no way to escape. But the important point that we have to realize is that those forms really never made saints. They just helped those who were inclined. They actually helped people more in the middle. They helped the middle ground people to remain steadfast. And now what's being asked of us, because we're moving into a higher age and because this is a different kind of path, it's not about dogma, is that we have to have that spirit of absolute renunciation within ourselves. And it isn't a question of whether we're householders or monks or nuns. It's entirely a question of how do we define ourselves? What is our self-definition? Where does our loyalty lie? Why am I living? What am I doing what I'm doing for? What is the purpose of my life? And how strongly on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis can I really give myself to God? And I really think it's very important for all of us as devotees to recognize, don't think that what's being asked of us is any less. Because of my own samskaras, I can relate very vividly to those stone monasteries. I like them. I every time I visit one of those stone places, we were in Greece somewhere. David, by contrast, was more on the King Janaka line. You know, he was more on the king and warrior than the isolated monk. And I have this little nuns. I used to joke that if you threw me up in the air and let me come down to my natural place, I'd land behind some convent wall in one of those little stone cells, and David would land in some palace somewhere, just, you know, equally detached. But it's just the way we're wired. I remember we were in Greece, and just in some, it was no longer an active monastery, but a little stone room with a little cold water tap, and I just huddled in there and just felt so at home. It just was such a barren place, but it just felt so natural to me. And, you know, I find the house we're living in a strange way, more of a tapasya. Just to have so much around me, it's very awkward for me. I try to accept it, and I do accept it as what's necessary, but it's not my natural habitat, so to speak. But what's very important for us to all realize is that nothing in this world is our natural habitat. That we belong to God and to God alone. And wherever He places us, we must serve with joy, but always like a servant in someone else's home. That's how Master put it so beautifully. A serving girl, this was in the culture of India, often the serving maids and the servants come from some village somewhere, and they come and live in the urban area, and they serve. And it's their good karma to do so. We talked about that earlier in the Gita. They get to expand their awareness and be in the company of more refined energy than they would in their own villages. But they never think of where they are as their home. Their home is always in the village. And so with us, we can do all this, and we do it dutifully, and we can raise the master's children as our own and take care of the master's house with the same care as if it were our own. But we always know that our home is in the village. And this is how in this particular section of the Gita, it's really emphasizing that the fact that the inner reality is the only reality. And they bring up this marvelous image, the city of the nine gates. You know, it's. I love the way they do these things. And we live within this city of the nine gates, the nine orifices through which the world comes into us, and we interact with the world. But it's just a fortress that surrounds us, and we dwell free within it. And we can barricade ourselves essentially by closing those gates. The image is really such a beautifully vivid image, or as Swamiji says, like a tortoise pulling its limbs inside. And then even if we are interacting, our sense of self-definition, you know, just reading these passages again and again, even just as words, they inspire us so deeply. I mentioned to some of you earlier before I started the class, Richard Salva has been helping to promote this book that I've written about Swami Kriyananda. Swami Kriyananda, as we've known him, it's not enough to write a book these days. You have to also do something to sell it. And Richard is an author himself and self-published and is really quite skillful at knowing how to pass the word out. So I've been doing a few radio shows, internet radio shows and things. We're just getting started. And he's written these questions that these people have asked me, and I'm having to learn how to answer them. It's not always obvious. And one question that I've been asked several times and answered very badly is, if a person wants to get started on self-transformation, what do you recommend as the first step? And that question has proved more difficult to answer in a pleasant soundbite than I first thought it would be. And so I've been mulling over in my mind, and I finally am coming to my own satisfaction with, like, what is the answer to that question? And I just visualize someone who has no prior experience. I realize the first thing you do is you have to add uplifting energy to your present reality. You can't just simply self-generate, like, oh, I think I'll just be different today. You have to draw energy from somewhere. And if you're entirely inexperienced, it's not easy to just draw energy from yourself. That we have to constantly feed our sense of inspiration. We have to put ourselves into a vibration that lifts our own level, or else we'll just sink back into our own level. We'll make a resolution and nothing will happen. It can happen through music. It can happen through good books, through recorded means, video or audio. But the best way, of course, is satsang, to really be in an inspiring atmosphere. And I was realizing that's why reading scripture has always been such an important part of spiritual practice, because it puts you in contact with the consciousness of a master. When Swamiji was writing these words, he's writing these words from his own experience, and he's writing these words from master's understanding of it. And it's scripture. The commentary itself is scripture. Master himself declared when he finished writing the commentary on the Gita, a new scripture has been born. And Swamiji has said, with true humility, which is to not to be afraid to claim a truth that's true. This book was channeled through him, and this is Master's commentary on the Gita. He wrote it in 3 months. It just can't be done other than that. And the book that has been published, with Master's name as the author, it doesn't reflect the same kind of energy that this does. There's no point in going into it. But Swamiji felt this is the book that Master said millions will find God through this, because it's readable. And there is a quality, at least I find it so, and I'm sure that all of you do also. You just read these words, and somehow or another, the state of consciousness that's being described opens out in front of you as if it were your own. And it is our own. It's exactly, because I'm only a medium singer, and I don't have the capacity to really sing well on my own, but my ear is not terrible, so I can sing much better in company than I sing by myself. It's such a vivid image to me. I always like to stand between Claire and Sharon or Sharmila or Brenda or somebody who has a strong voice who can really sing the part. And then all of a sudden, I just find I know what the notes are. They just come right out of my mouth, and I'm getting increasing confidence that they are the right notes. But I go off by myself, and I'm so certain of it. And then all of a sudden, I'm just waffling around all over the place, and I can tell that I've just completely lost it. But I come back with them, and I know exactly what it is again. It's just so obvious that, spiritually speaking, it just isn't enough to isolate ourselves. We also have to feed ourselves, because otherwise the wrong mental citizens gain mastery. The image that they're... It's very important to recognize how many contradictory forces exist within us. That's why that image of the city with 9 gates, which is our own consciousness, it's not an individual. It's a whole city full of mental citizens of all types. I used to think of it in this terms when I would talk to people. It's like we tend to think of ourselves as a devotee, on the long path to self-realization, and the vision you have is like this, long-distance runner, just solitary, going along this narrow pathway through the hills. But in fact, we're more like a football team, sort of outrunning, and including the injured players and including the coach and really including a lot of the people in the stands, too. It's like all of these different elements coexist within us. And after a while, we just have to relax about the absurd self-contradictions. I mean, we can contradict ourselves. In the course of 10 minutes, you can be 15 different people. From the point of view of in this moment, it's perfectly clear to you what you ought to do, and in the next moment, you've changed your mind, or you're acting contrary to that, or you're certain that you're going to keep this thought all day, and the next time you think of it is 5 in the evening and you can't remember what happened to it. It's just the football team is the image that I like to use, because the ball gets passed from hand to hand, and the ball is the focus of our attention. And sometimes the star quarterback, you know, has it, and he just nails the pass, and the best receiver grabs it, and he just goes through all obstacles and scores a touchdown. And the next time the quarterback is sacked, and he just gets knocked over, and the ball just dribbles over like this, and nobody even has it for a while, or it gets in the hands of the enemy. Isn't that what it feels like? It's just not, it's not clean. It's not simple. But understanding that it's natural to have that happen. I mean, a great deal of this chapter is how we can just come to peace with what is. The hardest thing on the spiritual path is just to come to peace with what is and not think, merely because all the klutzes have the ball, that means that you should just quit the game. It doesn't really make any difference. And over the masters repeat this to us. God doesn't care about our mistakes. And it's a mantra that we have to say again and again and again and again and again, because that self-judgment then leads to judging others, leads to a sense of divisiveness in our consciousness, and the way Master put it so sweetly in here, we're not able to approach God with an attitude of faith and trust. Because there's all these levels of worthy, unworthy in there. One of the images that is used in this chapter, which is so beautiful, the great ocean depths are never affected by even the most violent storm that takes place on the surface. And we're talking about the divine, unconditional love for us, but we're also talking about just as equally our own nature. This is a reality that I've been on the path almost 40 years now, and this is a point that is just beginning to make sense to me. I guess that's one of the reasons I'm so interested in it, because I've always had this sort of anxiety about living up to one's potential, and this necessity to do things, and this constant feeling that more is required and more needs to be done. And I've understood that hasn't brought me spiritual attunement. But it's a very, very hard delusion to unravel, because we're so persuaded that anxiety is fundamental to success, that it's very difficult to appreciate that there's really nothing at all wrong with us, that we just have to relax back into the divine reality. Now, Master is quick to say, this is not a license to continue sinning, he said. But they give us several ways to look at it. One of them is my favorite, that Maya acts through us. He tries to make this point that God created the delusion, but then he just stands back and the delusion just acts on us. It's like the wind is blowing on the ocean and we get knocked around by it, but it doesn't in any way affect our fundamental relationship to the ocean. And all that happens to us when we make an error is that we've just gotten caught up in that whirlwind again. It's not as if our own nature has actually been tainted. It's not as if even our aspirations have been reduced. You know, the fact that we feel such remorse, embarrassment, anxiety, discouragement every time we get whirled off course is a sign in itself saying that our aspiration has not been touched. If we were indifferent to our own behavior, then it would mean in some level or another we'd abandon our ideals. But the opposite is true. You know, that the revelation of our inability to live up to our ideals causes us intense suffering. But that suffering becomes our identity. And once we identify with that error, you see how we've compounded it? So much easier to say, oh, delusion, my, 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 how powerful it is. And very respectfully and humbly observe once again Delusion has touched us. Swamiji said recently in a talk he gave on September 12th at the celebration they had in India, and he said, I haven't always done the right thing, but I've always done my best. Very important distinction. But sometimes our best is really embarrassing. One just has to realize that. I used to have a mantra that I would say to myself, if I could have done better, I would have done better. You know, no one ever gets up and says, oh, let me see how badly I can behave today, even though often we do. But we get up with our ego just doing what it's doing, flapping in the breeze, and Maya grabs us. Master even tells us, and it's really amazing to meditate on it, because Master emphasizes it very strongly. Say that God did it through you. As Swamiji writes here, it's a little bit contradictory to the other way of saying it, that God stands outside of his Maya. But Master tells us that we should feel that everything that we do, God does through us. And even when we make errors, God is doing it through us. What could we be made of except the ocean? What could the wave consist of except the ocean water? And it's an extraordinarily important spiritual practice to extricate our minds from any self-condemning thought, because it doesn't help us to grow. It just helps us to remain separated. And they talk in this chapter too about spiritual progress is gradually refining our inner nature until no sense of separation remains. Isn't that an interesting way to put it? Just gradually refining and refining our nature. What are we refining away? We're refining away any aspect of ourselves that makes us feel separated from God. What makes us feel more separated than God, from God, than guilt over our own wrong action? You see? And then you have to add, God doesn't care about the wrong action, because from the point of view of the divine, it's just a little wave on the ocean. See, to us, it looms as all reality. But from the divine point of view, it's just a little wave on the ocean, and then the wave will go back. And Swamiji then starts talking in this thing about the illusion of time and space, which is a whole nother reality. Let me see what else is here. Swami comments on the simple thought that the most important tool for self-realization is a positive flow of energy and positive magnetism. And what we gradually have to appreciate on the spiritual path is that maintaining positive magnetism is the single most important thing that you can do. And we need to judge all actions by whether or not they help us to maintain that energy. And that's, again, why all thoughts of I've done wrong, I've made an error, are so unhelpful to us. Master made that interesting statement elsewhere, that if you know that a certain situation is going to defeat you, that the better part of wisdom is to run away from it. Isn't that interesting? Coupled with that, very early on the spiritual path, I faced a situation in which a person I didn't get along with moved out of my life. And I said something to Swamiji about how confusing it was to have a relationship that had seemed so important just dissolve and go away. And I felt insecure, and I asked Swami this question. I said, how can I ever trust anything that happens if such unexpected changes can take place? And his comment was, first of all, he said, well, maybe the karma is over. And then he let me sort of enjoy that for about a split second and then said, but I don't think so. He said, but sometimes we just learn as much as we can learn in a certain situation and we just can't go any farther. We have to just go in another direction and grow in another direction. We begin to lose positive magnetism at a certain point. Thinking about lifelong marriage, as Swamiji has commented on several occasions, that he doesn't really see it as any kind of a victory for people just to stay together when there's nothing creative or positive happening between them, merely to not separate and to say that that's a victory. He said it's only the only thing that really matters is if we're increasing our positive magnetism at all times. And all behavior should be judged by that. The word dharma is defined by that which increases our awareness and increases our positive magnetism. Now part of that is because, and I often talk about this, the real change comes when we get in tune with the guru's consciousness. And this comes back to my saying, what's the first thing to do if you want to start on self-transformation? You need to bring some dynamic energy into your reality, because these are the themes that have been just repeated over and over in this. The ego is already infected with that which we're trying to overcome. That's that whole story which we hear over and over about the village that was being troubled by a demon, and how the local witch doctor mixed up a powder and threw it on the demon. And then the next day the demon came back completely unchanged, and the shaman was distressed, but I threw the holy powder on you. And the demon said, well, I got into the powder before you threw it on me. So it didn't have any effect. Well, the image that's trying to be described is, we imagine that just with our own energy, we can shift our consciousness. But our own energy is our present consciousness. That there has to be this influx of magnetic energy from outside that bathes us, that refines us, that allows us to float above, that gives us a perspective we don't already have. In all the years that I had the opportunity to train directly with Swamiji, the training took many forms. But one was a very simple one, which is I would try out my ideas on him. I'm thinking of doing this, I'm thinking of doing that, what do you think? Or he would ask us about circumstances. He would make you speak. You know, what do you think we ought to do about this? What do you think about what so-and-so did? You know, how did you see the situation? And you had to have the courage to say what you thought. He would often ask for our input. And it wasn't just he wasn't just being nice. He was working with us. First of all, for us to have the courage to speak our minds. And then secondly, to have the courage to speak and be corrected. And so for many, many years, I was able to speak to Jyotish and to Swami, to Seva, just trying out my own thoughts and having reflected back to me what a bigger perspective looks like. In a class recently, someone asked me a question about developing intuition. I was almost surprised myself by the answer that came out of me. What I said was, I think that many people in this community take insufficient advantage of community. And by that, I mean, we need to ask each other more often, what should I do? There's this false belief that oneself is the only source of intuitive guidance. You know, that only I know what I should do. And I've been subject to that a great deal in myself, but it occurred to me one day that if God can speak through me, he's just as likely to speak through someone else. If God's inspiration can reach me, it can reach other people, and they can be God's instrument. I don't mean that as stupid as that sounds, but the simple fact is there's no reason why guidance for you should come only through you. But much more important than that, inner guidance is very, very subtle, and it's extremely helpful to just put our ideas in front of others whose wisdom we have grown to trust. It doesn't mean, you know, that they're God-realized and they can just speak and give you the answer, but you test it against someone else's perception. Does this make sense to you? Does this seem to be a positive thing? It must be people who you know won't just support you in your ignorance, but either have the capacity or the willingness to really answer you truly. But we really need to work together in order to understand what's true. And then what happens when we do that is that gradually we get enough experience of intuition coming out right. And I'm talking over years, I'm not talking immediately. Intuition is not easy to hear because there's many levels within us. And I mean, the first step toward developing superconscious intuition is simply to try to be guided from within and to try to be original in one's own responses, which is to say, to come from one's point of origin instead of just going along with the crowd or doing what everybody else does. But once you have interiorized your perspective, we must also be aware of the fact that subconscious and conscious can also masquerade and speak with great force and authority. It's very dangerous because sometimes we just become so self enclosed in the wrong way that we feel very in harmony because we're not allowing any interfering thoughts to enter. We're guided only by ourselves, but we're guided only by our own egos. And so we feel very in tune with ourselves. Nothing disturbs us. It's exceedingly important for self-transformation to constantly be drawing in that other reality. And if we're disciples, to draw in a very concentrated way, specifically the vibrations of this path, to try to act at all times in attunement with the principles as Swamiji has offered them to us, the ways of Ananda. It's not a small thing to do that. Swami writes in here that it's the power of the Guru's consciousness that lifts us out of the ego and into the infinite. Swamiji is talking here about... Actually, I think I'll take a little break first before I go into another subject. Okay, let's stop for a few minutes. Power of seed. Environment is stronger than willpower. Talking on these radio shows, trying to say to people, you know, think about the music you listen to. But people's idea of spiritual music is very emotional. They don't even have any idea what they're really looking for. Why don't we just wait a minute? Okay, go ahead.
Uh-huh. And, you know, I was sitting here for a bit, you know, just feeling like my energy is compressed.
Mm-hmm. This switching things around and realizing that the infinite is already ours, we just have to improve our knowing it. And it said, in this section of the Gita, it said over and over and over again in all these different ways, the whole approach of spirituality from the West has been that we're born in sin and we struggle upwards and that our true nature is really the darkness, but in Christianity, by the grace of Jesus Christ and his death on the cross, we are washed clean and therefore we can ascend, but we're being allowed to do something that's not natural to us. Whereas the whole Oriental point of view is that the divinity is present. We've just gotten a little confused. In other words, that the natural point of rest is the exalted state, and that it takes a great deal of tension to keep us out of that. And I've heard these thoughts for decades, and I've always countered them with my own subconscious commitment to thinking that, but I must work hard, and I'm not working hard enough. You know, all this deep identification with a sense of personal unworthiness that caused me to say yes, but to all of those teachings. And lately, I think it's because I've just turned 60, and every 12 years, a kind of segment of spiritual development happens. Things kind of come to a completion, because the Jupiter in the horoscope, which is the guru, makes a complete circuit and starts over. At least I've experienced that. You've heard me talk about this, that every 12-year cycle for me has been an incremental shift. Never a gigantic, you know, thing, but just a turning, a better orientation. And the orientation has always been, this one especially, but really all of them have been to a deeper understanding of that simple fact. That's right. My true nature is divine. My really deep true nature is divine. And when everything is over and calms down again, that's the default setting. And we just get all snarled up, like we get kind of, you know, messed up in this blanket. There's a very funny movie called New Leaf, I think is what it's called. It's an old movie with Elaine May, and it's written by Mike Nichols and has Walter Matthau, and it's very funny. And Elaine May plays this really daffy heiress to a fortune, and Walter Matthau has frivolously spent all his money, so he has to marry a rich woman in order to keep himself from being poor, which is just unthinkable to him. And they're both really goofy, and it's a very sweet story. And eventually he does marry her, and she comes out on her wedding night, and she's such a sort of klutz, and she has bought this Grecian gown that she's going to wear. And so it has only one armhole, and then it's supposed to be a bare shoulder. But she gets herself caught in it. And there's just this hilarious scene in the movie where she's trying to make this romantic impression, but in fact she's just caught in this gown. She has her head in there, she has her arm through the neck hole, and because, you know, she's a very funny physical comedian, and so is Walter Matthau, they do this whole scene trying to get her straightened out in this robe, and she just can't. Then finally they find a way to get her head through the right hole and so on. But I sometimes think of that scene, that that's sort of what happens to us. We just start getting, we get all twisted up in our samskaras, and we've got our arm going through the head hole, and we're trying to get our head through the arm hole, and we can't see anything when you're like that. You know, you're crimped and you're bound, and you believe that that's reality. But as soon as you come out in the right place, it all just falls into place again. And that's the extraordinary cycle, isn't it, that we go through. And one of the reasons why continuously renewed satsang is so important. We have occasional events here, like we had on September 12th, where we came together to celebrate Swamiji's anniversary. And I always wish that so many more people would come than do come, because the healing properties of those events are so intense, because what they heal is our sense of separation. In those moments when the energy is so uplifted, there's just no doubt in your heart and mind that you are loved by God and always have been. And the freedom that all that implies, and for those 2 or 3 hours or whatever it is, you just know. And then you walk out, and like they often say, that you dip in the Ganges and all your sins are washed away. But the problem is they just wait in the trees, and when you come out of the river, they drop back on you again. And it is true. You may be washed away in that moment, but then they come back, but never quite with the same force. Just thinking of that, I was thinking of a ridiculous India story. This woman, she could never be on time, and she was always making the whole tour bus wait, and she was always a little confused, and it just wasn't going right. And she couldn't seem to understand the importance of relating to other people's realities. And we went, and there was this particularly agitated time in which the whole bus had to wait for her, and she was so anxious and like this. And we went up, it was Shivananda's ashram in Rishikesh, and we went up and we sat under the tree, and we were talking about, you know, this karma that she had to make everyone upset. And right then, a monkey just pooped all down her back. Just fell on her like that. And fortunately, she was a person who didn't freak out by things like that. And we just looked at that, and I said, you know, it's just like the karmic power is just dumping on you completely. And she laughed and laughed, and from that moment, she was always on time. You know, it just sort of like, it just had to take really visible form, like what's happening in this world. And then you change. There's just moments when we really get it. And on the positive side, speaking of that kind of inspiration, you just renew. The way it's described in the Indian tradition, and it's really true, is that we're covered by 3 sheaths, that the purity of our own nature has 3 koshas. There's no Western word for it. Sheath is the word they use, but they're koshas. They're layers of density that keep us from knowing. And Swamiji describes the innermost over the causal body is just a thin veil. Then we wrap a shawl around that. Then we put a blanket on top of that. So we can't move and we can't see. We're trapped in that gown and we don't have our appendages going in the right direction. But all we have to do is just take those, remove those garments, and the light that is in us emerges. And that's the way to take every time you feel down or depressed or a sense of discouragement about your own spirituality, just realize all you're doing is putting another blanket around yourself. And the way to get out of that is not to heap that blanket on more strongly, but to go into the inner city of nine gates and fortify yourself in there. And from that perspective, dissolve those blankets. Because you have not been affected by the mere surface storm. It's so, and Swami tries to describe in there how vastly different is the perspective that we live in from our true perspective. One is petty, limiting, whatever the words he uses. It's just, one is personal, confined, even petty, is how he thought about it. Petty in the sense of so full of petty concerns. You know, just little concerns. You know, life becomes really small. What am I going to eat? How am I going to be taken care of? What will become of my body? What will these people think of me? Where will I fit into that reality? What will I do? How will I find my place? And the other is so impersonal and just unlimited in its perspective and omnipresent, which is to say everybody's reality is just as important as my own. Swami makes the simple statement. What did he say? It was so interesting. He was talking about crossing the barrier of time and relating to those who lived before by living intensely in the moment. Let's see, where was it? I just wanted to say it exactly as he put it. Oh, now I can't find the word. But what he was saying was how that everything in creation is just another aspect of your own self. And that everyone that's not you, everything that is not yourself, is just another aspect of your infinite self. Isn't that an interesting thought? I mean, just literally looking around this room, we all know each other really well. We all know each other by name. We know our habits. And of course, you know, I am me and you are you, and we're all very distinct individuals in this room. But just really realize that every other consciousness that you're looking at is no less your own self than the one that you're inhabiting. That was, I quoted at Sunday service, when Anandamayi Ma was being pressed upon by devotees who wanted her darshan by getting close to her and were reaching for her, and her devotees became alarmed that she would become disturbed by all those people touching her. And she said, if your hand touches your leg, she said, why would you be disturbed? It's just yourself touching yourself. She said, I am as much those bodies pressing into me. She said, I am this body, I am those bodies, and I am all the space in between. Isn't it just, imagine, that's the omnipresent perspective, that even though we walk around animating this one, the reality is that we're in all of them. Now, for me, certainly that's an affirmation. It's not something that I perceive. When writing about Swamiji, there's several stories in which the point of the story is that I had to appreciate that behavior on my part that was an affirmation of right attitude on his part was simply the way he saw reality. And the specific example, one of them was when I thanked him for, in all the 30-some years I had known him, that he had never used the fact that I was younger and inexperienced against me. He'd never even mentioned it. He'd always treated me just straight across. Whatever my experience was, that was my experience, and we would discuss it back and forth. He wouldn't take my word for it, but he never said anything like, well, you're young and you'll learn, you know, or how do you know you're so young? He never made any reference to my age. And when I told him how much I appreciated that, because in my own position now, I'm old enough to be working with people who are much younger than I, and sometimes the thought crosses my mind. Well, you haven't had any experience yet, that's why you think like this. And because of the way Swami treated me, I don't articulate that thought, and I do my best to take it out of my mind and just take people as they are. But it crosses my mind. And when I commented to Swami how much I appreciated the fact that he never said anything like that to me, he looked very puzzled. He just looked puzzled. And then he responded, well, I never noticed. He said, I never think of people as the is their age. He said the soul is ageless. He said it's just the age of the body. He said, I don't look at people. I look at their consciousness. And in another context, similarly, when this couple was getting divorced, and we were discussing it in a small dinner we were having with Swami, and I remarked that a few weeks earlier, or a few months earlier, I had gone shopping with the woman, and we were trying to buy a shirt for her husband, and I took one off the rack, and I said, well, this would be beautiful. This would really bring out the color of his eyes. This is the same color as his eyes. She said, is it? I don't know what color his eyes are. So we're having this dinner party, and I said, well, no wonder they're getting divorced. She doesn't know what color his eyes are. I mean, it was just such a bizarre concept to me. Swami, again, looked just puzzled. He said, I never know what color people's eyes are. And then he commented about Seva, with whom he worked very closely, who has these huge brown eyes. It was just, you know, her whole defining feature. And then he said, Seva, for example, he said, I don't know what color her eyes are. And she was right at the table, and he looked at her, and he said, oh, they're brown, like that. I mean, it was just like, we didn't know what to think. He said, I don't look at people's eyes. He said, I look through their eyes to their consciousness. And he just literally does not see their physical eyes. And he said, I never see people's age because I don't look at their physical body. I look at the consciousness that's coming through it. Now, that's not an effort on his part. It's not like he trains himself to be neutral. I'm training myself to be neutral. That's just what the world looks like to him. Now, it's just so marvelous to contemplate that, just to solve the problems of our consciousness by shifting our consciousness. All problems are problems of consciousness. If consciousness is different, no problems exist. I've tried to think of it recently. When I bring up old problems especially, this is just a vritti in the spine. If I dissolve that vritti, then the situation ceases to exist. If I didn't have a magnetic whirlpool in my chakra, the situation wouldn't exist anymore. That's all that it is. And there's that I've always remembered, the book by Stephen Levine called Who Dies. It's now, was written 30 years ago at least. It was the beginning of the whole movement of conscious and more conscious dying than just in the hospitals. And he goes through this whole process of what death is about, and I still remember it so vividly. And he talks about how when the dying person, if you die slowly and not in a sudden accident, you gradually lose control over your body. You become weaker and weaker, and you can't do the things that you used to be able to do. I remember when this young woman at Ananda Village was close to death. She was lying in a sort of uncomfortable, what looked to us like an uncomfortable position, with her head off to one side. And someone said, why don't you just move your head? She said, you have no idea how much effort it takes to move my head. And I visited this young woman who was dying of AIDS. Somebody asked me to go see her. And I think she was still able to make it, walk into the bathroom and walk out, but she sort of like, she had no feeling in large parts of her body, and she would sort of get stuck because she wouldn't know that she was like sort of up against the wall with her arm, and she would just suddenly find she couldn't get through the door, and she'd have to kind of investigate and figure out what was, because her energy was just withdrawn from all these different parts. So Stephen Levine talks about how we are so habituated that when there's some agitation in our consciousness, we solve it by some physical action. I feel restless, I think I'll get in the car, I'll go see a movie. I'm feeling a little hungry, I think I'll get up and see what's in the refrigerator. I'm feeling a little annoyed, I think I'll go play tennis for a while. But what happens as you get closer and closer to death, he was saying, that your consciousness does not automatically go into a state of harmony. But what happens is you no longer have the opportunity to solve the problems of consciousness by using the body to distract you from what's happening. So he says you lie on the bed and you have to face the problems of consciousness entirely on the level of consciousness. And then he's describing the state that dying people often go through, which is one of extreme agitation. Because basically they're being utterly bombarded by all those dissonant feelings and they have no control over them. In the stages of dying, often a person goes through that to a state of great surrender. But that phrase, they have to solve the problems of consciousness entirely on the level of consciousness, has never left me. And it's a very good practice, and one highly recommended practice. When you feel any level of agitation, don't try to solve it psychologically. Don't try to solve it by self-justification or rationalization or any of those things. Just try to solve it on the level of consciousness by removing the sheaths of the koshas that actually allow you even to have that perspective, to be so petty in our self-concern that we're actually worried about ourselves. I'm not saying to fool yourself or to pretend, but at least make an attempt just to lift your awareness to such a level that your whole perspective of consciousness changes. As Swami writes, you have no idea how different our actual reality is compared to the one that we have become identified with. And there's so much power in this because sooner or later, this is who we're going to become. So do we play around with lesser solutions or do we start even now at least making the effort to solve our problems in the right direction by lifting our consciousness to greater and greater awareness? Isn't that a lovely plan? Okay, that's all I have to say tonight. If there's any comments or questions, if not, we'll call it a night.